I'm ready.
Perfect. That's good, because the music started.
We're
if
all
you weren't ready, then it's too late.
Hi, I'm Kimberly Adams. Welcome to Make Me Smart, where none of us is as smart as all of us.
I'm Kai Risdahl. It is Tuesday, which means it's time for the weekly deep dive into a single topic. Today, it's Title 42, which, when it started, was nominally a rule that let the United States government restrict immigration from certain places when there is a public health crisis. You've heard it in the news a lot a year or two ago, and certainly recently as well.
Because the Trump administration used it at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic to basically justify turning away migrants and asylum seekers at the border, sometimes returning them to their own countries or sometimes returning them to Mexico. And then recently, on recently the CDC announced that it would end the use of Title 42 on May the 23rd. However, now that seems to be maybe not going to happen.
Yeah, there's a lot that we don't know about this thing, which is why we've got it on the show today. Denise Gilman is director of the Immigration Clinic, also a professor of law at the University of Texas at Austin. Professor Gilman, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Could you give us the official sort of actual explanation of what Title 42 is, please, first of all?
Well, you all did an excellent job of describing it. It is a program that comes under the public health laws, which allowed the Centers for Disease Control to issue an order saying that those who were representing, those who were presenting themselves at the southern border, very specifically asylum seekers presenting themselves at the southern border, would be stopped from entering, accessing the U.S. asylum system, and instead would be immediately sent back either to their home countries or to Mexico if Mexico would take them. It was always based on the idea that this was a pandemic control measure, but from the very beginning, there were high-level officials at the CDC who said that this really wasn't very logical as a disease control measure. It was really always about immigration control. And now, of course, there's even more question, given the state of the pandemic, as to whether there's really any aspect of it that's about disease control.
Why asylum seekers specifically?
Well, the stated justification was that asylum seekers require more processing at the border facilities because they have to be processed into the asylum system. They aren't going to be either immediately rejected, as non-asylum seekers might be, nor are they going to be just quickly processed through because they have a U.S. passport or a visa. So it is true that there's a little bit more processing that needs to take place for this particular category of individuals, and that was kind of the justification. But actually, Title 42 didn't really prevent that. In other words, even when people are expelled under Title 42, they have to be processed for that purpose. And so you are still seeing that people are held, asylum seekers are held in Border Patrol facilities for some time while they're processed through this system.
So the Trump administration, before we get to present day and the honestly mess, right? It's a political mess and it's a policy mess. But the Trump administration was famously, shall we say, not in favor of immigration. And they used the pandemic to enact fundamentally immigration policies. Did it work for the Trump administration just in that period of time?
Well, right. So I do think, as I say, there really was never any great public health justification for this. There was always the reality that even with these automatic expulsions, there was going to be processing. So even that minimal justification that, well, this category of asylum seekers takes more time to process never made a lot of sense. So it was always clear that this was really about shutting down the border to asylum seekers on political grounds. Did it work? I mean, yes, if your goal is to block access to the asylum system for vulnerable individuals fleeing persecution, despite the fact that international law and U.S. law provide very clearly for the right to access a protection procedure. It worked. It prevented many, many vulnerable asylum seekers from accessing the system.
And what's been the human impact of that, both at the border and in the countries that folks end up going back to?
Right. So the impacts have been really, truly horrific. Many individuals have been sent back to Mexico. We're now at the range of around 10,000 documented cases of migrants, asylum seekers who have been harmed seriously on the Mexico side of the border, often very soon after they are sent back across the bridge into Mexico by U.S. officials who know that the cartels are there waiting for them on the Mexico side, because this is a very vulnerable group sort of being sent directly back into their hands by the U.S. authorities. And then for many, if they were not sent back to Mexico, where they faced this kind of cartel violence there, they were sent all the way back to their home countries that they had fled, often because of extreme violence that they were very fearful would repeat itself. And we are hearing stories of people who've been sent back to Honduras or El Salvador and have faced, again, violence anew in their home countries.
And now, a year and a half-ish, whatever it is, into the Biden administration, it is in court. A district judge has blocked the Biden administration from ending the use of Title 42. It's a policy mess in Congress. Now what happens?
It's a really good question. There is very, very little explanation for how the program could possibly continue at this point when mask mandates are being taken down. Every other pandemic control measure has really been lifted for the most part. And particularly when there are very strong measures in place now, as there weren't at the beginning at the border, for testing, vaccination, quarantine, all of the rest. The program was always both over-inclusive and under-inclusive because it focused on asylum seekers rather than those who might be most likely to be bringing COVID, and under-inclusive in that it didn't get those who might be actually carrying the disease, the virus, even a citizen, U.S. citizens, for example. So there was never a lot of explanation, but now you
really— Wait, what do you mean by that?
Well, so U.S. citizens were always able to go back and forth across the border. Title 42 never impacted them. Title 42 always had big holes, exemptions for commercial truck drivers bringing tomatoes, for example. And those individuals could just as likely have COVID. This is not to say that they shouldn't have been allowed to come. It's to say that a better focus would have been on identifying those who might actually be bringing COVID and adopting COVID measures relating to those instances, like quarantine, like testing and the rest, rather than just scooping up all asylum seekers, which was, as I say, sort of over-inclusive because it got all asylum seekers, regardless of any indications. You know, many of them may have had vaccinations, may have tested negatively, scooped them up anyway, and it didn't scoop up those who might well have had the possibility of bringing the virus. So, like I say, there was never much explanation for it, but now it's very hard to see any explanation. And to be clear, even what's happening in the courts is more complicated than just the district court decision saying that Title 42 should continue, because there's also a D.C. appellate court federal decision saying that Title 42 in its broadest application actually is unlawful, that it can't be applied to return people to situations of danger, that there has to be much more rigorous screening before people can be expelled. It can't be this automatic expulsion. And so even in the courts, you have sort of competing decisions. And then, yes, there's certainly very strong debate at the policy level as well. I genuinely hope and believe that we can see our way through this. There is no logic to continuing the program at this point. To the extent there need to be different kinds of border measures put into place, we can talk about that rather than trying to graft on this public health regimen onto an immigration asylum issue. And in fact, the administration has proposed and is set to implement new regulations for asylum screening at the border. Those regulations have some good things for asylum advocates and some less good things for asylum advocates, but they definitely are an attempt to actually get at the issues of how do you humanely process. There are going to be some large numbers of asylum seekers in coming months, and that's where we should be focused rather than on this public health measure.
Go ahead.
Said
Go ahead. No, go ahead, because I was going to take it someplace else.
Yeah, you said that there's no good reason to keep it going, but what you just mentioned is probably in the very cynical political minds of folks here in the fair city of Washington, D.C., a reason in itself. We're heading into the midterms, and a lot of the politicians, especially on the Democratic side, are worried about what it would look like to have so many people crossing the border around this time.
Right. That is absolutely a political consideration that is playing into all of this. There is no doubt about it. And I think it is notable that the Biden administration has decided that they're just really can be no argument for the program anymore. And so they are moving to end it despite the political realities out there. I wish if I had a magic wand, honestly, that they had ended the program much earlier, then it wouldn't be happening sort of right at this very juncture where it is even more complicated. However you see the issue, it's just going to be more complicated with the high stakes of the midterm elections coming up. So it just makes it a whole lot messier. Whereas if it had happened, if the end of Title 42 had happened earlier, we wouldn't be quite in this place. But honestly, I think the best way to address the reality that, yes, the numbers are going to be relatively high in the coming months is to recognize, first of all, that that is a product of Trump administration policies around Title 42, border restrictions, also the Remain in Mexico program. There are people who have been waiting trapped in Mexico for 3 to 4 years now who are entitled to access the asylum system. And so it's going to take a little while to process those folks in. And we just have to recognize that and recognize that that's what the rule of law really requires. That's what the law is to recognize that there are people in need of protection and to process them appropriately and humanely. The second thing is that we can do this. That's the second, I think, important political point to be made right now. As I say, there are new regulations that would streamline some of the processes. We have the resources if we bring them to the border, and there has been a good deal of planning acknowledging that there are going to be these larger numbers in the coming months. So the resources can be brought to bear. The numbers of asylum officers need to be raised to be there at the border. The facilities for reception, shelters right in the border area where migrants, asylum seekers usually only stay for hours or days until they go to live with family in various parts of the country. But those shelters are ready and willing to receive asylum seekers. A number of border communities have made very clear that they are very anxious to support asylum seekers as they pass through their towns.
Let me just super quick piggyback on, well, maybe it's not super quick, I don't know, piggyback on something that Kimberly said, the politics of this thing. I had a little bit of a rant on the podcast a week or two ago, and it went fundamentally like this. I think immigration, perhaps even more than national security, immigration is the clearest example of Congress abdicating its responsibilities under the Constitution and leaving all the really hard decisions to the executive. Now that I've got an expert on the phone, what do you think of my theory?
Well, I think that's right, except Boom. That Congress Oh. has actually Congress has actually provided pretty clearly for a process for asylum seekers. In 1980, the Refugee Act of 1980,
not just asylum, right? I mean, immigration overall.
Right. Absolutely. But I think it's a mistake to conflate the border and immigration overall, first of all. Okay. So I think what we're seeing at the border is mostly a situation right now, and I'm not going to say it would never change, mm-hmm. but right now, it's largely an asylum seeker situation. Mm-hmm. And there is legislation since 1980 that has worked for decades that we should be using to allow for processing of asylum seekers that brings down into U.S. law our international human rights obligations and refugee law obligations. And so if Congress wants to change that system, then it should do so. And that may be a place where there's inaction. But I don't really really see any good need. I think what needs to happen is that we need to comply with that law and recognize that the numbers really don't overwhelm that law. Yes, resources need to be brought to bear, but we can do this. Then in terms of the larger immigration policy, yes, absolutely. There has been such an ongoing battle in Congress and in the political sphere in general for so many years now that nothing happens. I think both sides of the issue see that there could be positive changes, although we may mean very different things by saying the system is broken and we need reform. But there is an acknowledgement that there needs to be change, and nothing happens. So yes, the executive has to step in and do what it can to try to move the system forward in meaningful ways.
Last one, I'm going to let you go. But you were talking about that there's a system in place that could work. And it's worth noting it is working for some people. Ukrainian refugees and asylum seekers are able to cross the border right now. And I'm wondering what you think of the timing of the Biden administration's announcement that it wanted to lift Title 42, which happened around the same time that Ukrainian refugees started coming to the U.S.-Mexico border.
Well, you're certainly pointing to a reality that is just impossible to ignore, which is that even the very, very restrictive measures that have been put in place, Title 42 and before that Remain in Mexico and before that some metering wait lists at the border, have all been pretty clearly discriminatory, mostly towards people coming from Latin America and Haiti, and have never been applied in the same way, even to those sometimes coming from Venezuela, just a little further south and a little less clearly Latino, less people of color. And the Ukraine situation just brought that all to a head when it became very clear that Ukrainians would be allowed to enter the United States despite ongoing application of Title 42 and Remain in Mexico currently at this point. And so it just made it all very clear, particularly following not too far along after the very vivid images of Haitians being chased on horseback at the border, which was really a Title 42 implementation issue as well. Just the juxtaposition was very harsh. So I expect that that did have something to do with the reality that the ending of the Title 42 was just absolutely necessary at this point. But I think it also coincided quite tightly with the limitation on COVID restrictions that were also coming into play, the lifting of mask mandates and the rest. It just seemed really hard to justify a COVID measure at the border that was pushing people back to Mexico or to their home countries at the same time that most COVID mandates in the United States were being lifted.
Guess we're going to have to wait and see what happens next. Denise Gilman, director of the Immigration Clinic and law professor at the University of Texas at Austin, thank you so much.
Thanks for your time, Professor. Really appreciate it.
Well, I learned something. I'm scoring on Title 42 now, so that's good. Right?
Yeah. I didn't realize that we had a system that kind of functions well, if implemented.
If implemented, right?
Yeah.
Totally.
We just have to see if it can be applied equally in some ways.
Right. Well, tell you what, let us know what you thought about that conversation, what surprised you, what didn't, what questions you still have, because, you know, just because we do it once doesn't mean we can't do it again if we didn't get to all of the things we need to know. Our phone number is 508-827-6278, also known as 508-UB-SMART. You can send us a voice memo if you like, makemesmart@marketplace.org. Back is what we shall be. All right, news fix time. I'm going to go first because mine's light and fluffy and yours is much more substantive. did you see in the New York Times today that a House subcommittee next week is going to hold the first open congressional hearing on unidentified flying objects in more than 50 years?
I saw it when you linked to the story, and I'm very excited, yes. And I will be tuning in.
Yes.
I will be watching.
Yes. Remember, there was this whole thing last summer about these Navy videos and the whole, you know, these guys in the cockpit going, oh, look at that dude, and they couldn't figure it out. Anyway, thanks in large part to the now departed Harry Reid, all this stuff is coming out into the open, and I think it's fascinating, and I will be watching that, and I think we all should too.
I remember when that came out, you know, that they were going to release all this information publicly. And there was so much happening at the time that it barely made a ripple.
Yep.
And I remember thinking, and a lot of people commenting on the time at the time that, like, the U.S. government just acknowledged that UFOs are real. And everyone's just another day.
Tuesday.
It was like such a flood of news at the time and just everything going haywire. And we were all just like, UFOs. Yeah, sounds about right.
Yep. So next week, hearing, we will bring you the update when it happens because I just think it's fascinating.
Okay. Well, my news fix comes from Bloomberg. I mean, it was from a hearing, so I mean, anybody can see it, C-SPAN, whatevs. But to reinforce what you and Molly said when you talked about reproductive rights being economic rights, Janet Yellen, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, was testifying to Congress today, I think it was.
Yeah, it was today. Yeah, yeah.
Senate Banking Committee, and somebody asked her a question about the overturning of Roe versus Wade, and she weighed in on it, and she said that eliminating the right to access abortion services, quote, would have very damaging effects on the economy and would set women back decades. And, you know, she pointed to all this research in economics that said, you know, it would be economically harmful to women, to children, and really kind of got into how a woman being able to, I'm sorry, people who give birth or who might want to have abortions, who want to be able to make choices about their life and their career and their financial ability to raise a child, taking away that has economic consequences, as you laid out. And so, it's worth watching what she has to say.
And it's also worth pointing out here that Janet Yellen is the first woman to have the job she has now, first woman to chair the Fed, and first woman to run the Council of Economic Advisors of the White House. I mean, it's...
This is true.
You know, it just... Yeah.
And it's another example of how this is really touching so many parts of government, economy, social life, religious life. This is just sucking up everything into it.
Yep, sure is.
Right. Okay.
Jake, let's do it.
Mailbag.
Hi, Kai and Kimberly.
This is Godfrey from San Francisco.
Jesse from Charleston, South Carolina.
And I have a follow-up question.
It has me thinking and feeling a lot of things.
All right. I actually don't know what this first voice memo is going to sound like, so just all y'all listen up. I will listen at the same time, and we'll figure it out. Here we go.
Okay, it's April from L.A. Try one more time, and let's see if you can hear it. And I swear this sounds like our own Kimberly Adams.
Starting route to Los Angeles International Airport. See to Leffingwell Road, then turn left.
Right? It sounds just like her. All right, thanks. Bye.
You know? All right, so look, if she hadn't actually said it sounded like you, I wouldn't have picked it up. But now that she did, I buy it.
That would be Apple's American female voice number two. And
Do you get it all the time?
Because this is not the first person who has flagged this for me.
That's so
funny. When they first rolled out the new voices, someone tagged me on Twitter and they were like, did they use your voice for this?
I love that. That's
and
great.
And I'll admit, at first I was like, oh, they're just saying that because, you know, it was supposedly a black woman's voice and whatever. But then I was on a road trip with a friend and we were like, okay, let's check it out. And we switched our navigation to Apple woman voice number two. And it was the most disorienting thing I have ever heard in my life.
That is too funny.
Because it does sound like
it does. It totally does.
And so there's a Make Me Smart connection to this, actually. Because I actually tracked down the person who originally sent me that tweet, and I asked him sort of how he made the connection, and he said that, you know, he and his wife were listening to the Siri voice, and they're like, it sounds so familiar. And then they were listening to Make Me Smart, and I was on, and they were like, that's who it sounds
that's
like.
That's great.
So.
That's great.
Yeah, it's eerie. It's really weird.
I bet. There you go. That's
yeah,
cool.
It's disorienting.
I dig
but,
it.
Yeah.
That's great.
Okay. All right, so we also got this note from Carolyn in Hawaii.
This is a comment about the story regarding dog breeds and genetics and personality. I've been a veterinarian for 22 years, and I agree, stop picking on the pit bulls. The vast majority of them have been sweet goofballs. But some things you can't talk me out of. Golden retrievers are the best huggers, and that is a hill that I am willing to die on. Thank you, and keep making me smart.
That is true. That is true. I got a golden.
I don't know. My mother had a Yorkie poo that every time she came into the house, he'd like hug her leg, and it was like a full-on embrace.
Wow. We sure it was hugging? Adorable. No, I'm sorry. That's all.
Positive. I knew you were going
to
say
Look,
that.
Look, somebody had
it.
To. I am not the only person listening to this podcast who thought of that. I am not.
It was definitely a hug.
Okay. Speaking of dogs, because I don't know, Bridget went all in. What if Marketplace was all dogs all the time? What would that sound like? Here we go.
The thing about this economy right now, treats might not be market drivers as much as we thought. Also, a little bit later on, cats, love them or hate them. Yep, that old chestnut.
Love her.
From American Canine Media, this is Marketplace.
Oh my God. So. All right, Jake, let's dial that down.
I'm Kai Rufstall.
Oh God! So that was Max in Brooklyn. Said he was inspired by Luke Burbank on Twitter. Luke Burbank, who does Too Beautiful to Live. He's on Wait every now and then. Anyway, he actually made a Twitter joke about making a podcast focused entirely on the pet economy, which is like $70 billion. So Max had some spare time up in Brooklyn, and I guess just got creative. I don't even know.
That was creative. That was fun.
That was very creative.
Kai Rufstall.
Oh, God.
that may have to stay around.
You get Apple directions, and I get that. Okay, fine. Sure.
Well, I mean, you could wonder. So one of the questions that happens about that is, like, there's a lot of audio of my voice on the internet.
Oh, yeah. No,
and so,
I know.
Like, did their AI, like, scrape my voice or something? And and if my voice can be so easily replicated, what purpose is there for me in the world? Anyway,
I hear you.
Before we go, we are going to leave you with this week's answer to the Make Me Smart question, which is, what is something you thought you knew but later found out you were wrong about?
Hi, Make Me Smart. This is Ryan from San Diego. I wanted to share something I thought I knew but turned out I was wrong about, is that I would become part of the Big Quit. I was recently looking at my career, and I wasn't moving fast enough along as I wanted to, so I looked at other jobs. I also thought that my company would try to do more to keep me, but turns out there's nothing they could offer me. So I'm moving along to step into a new job, going from oil and gas to med devices. I never thought I would do it, but we'll see what the future holds.
I think a lot of people had that experience thinking that their companies would do more to keep them, but and it's just like, nope.
Yeah.
But congratulations on the step in a new direction. Yep. Wish you luck.
Yeah.
All right. Keep sending us all of your answers to the Make Me Smart question via voice memo to our email at makemesmart@marketplace.org, or you can leave us that voice message at 508-827-6278. 508, you be smart.
Make Me Smart is directed and produced by Marissa Cabrera. Ellen Rolfes writes our newsletter. Our intern is Tiffany Bowie.
Today's program was engineered by Jake Cherry with mixing by Charlton Thorpe. Bent Holiday, and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. The senior producer is Bridget Bodner. Donna Tam is the director of On Demand, and Marketplace's vice president and general manager is Neil Scarborough. We should do the credits in the Apple voice one time and see how it sounds.
That'd be great.
There's like a couple of words that she says that are very different from how I would say them, but a lot of it is quite similar.
That is too funny.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.